Case number 68851, Brinkerhoff versus Foote. We have Mr. Hayward, Mr. Ray. Hayward, on behalf of Brinkerhoff.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Dan Hayward with Lack, Salt, and Nomura up in Reno, and I'm here representing the appellant, Bruce Brinkerhoff. If I may, just a few words about the basic pertinent facts in this matter. The suit arises out of a dispute between two former friends and business partners, shareholders, in a corporation called WET, actually Water Extraction Technologies, Inc., WET for short, which is a sort of a home disaster cleanup recovery type business up in Reno Sparks. Mr. Foote founded that business and approached Mr. Brinkerhoff, whom he knew through church, in early 2003 about joining him as a partner in that business, as a fellow shareholder. There were numerous communications back and forth, both orally and through emails, about a potential buy-in, the terms of Mr. Brinkerhoff's buy-in to the corporation. And there was a key exchange on January 1st of 2004, where the proposal on the table was a $400,000 total buy-in or valuation of Mr. Brinkerhoff's 50% to be paid as follows: $200,000 down on January 1st of 2004, that day, and four $50,000 annual installments every year thereafter. But this proposal also provided for other things. Mr. Brinkerhoff would immediately become a 25% shareholder. Mr. Brinkerhoff would receive a $42,000 salary. And because Mr. Brinkerhoff would be a part owner in 2004, they wanted to make it clear that Mr. Foote, who had been the sole owner with his wife in 2003, would receive the receivables from those 2003 jobs, which made sense that they would clarify that with Mr. Brinkerhoff being a part owner. Well, that's not what happened. Mr. Foote explained at trial that there was a meeting at Baldini's Casino. I'm not sure if that's in Reno or Sparks, but in Reno Sparks. And as a result of that meeting, the proposal changed. It would still be a $400,000 valuation for the 50% interest, but there would be an initial $200,000 payment, again on January 1 of 2004, and five $40,000 payments, the first of which was also due on January 1st of 2004, but was waived in exchange for Mr. Foote keeping the profit or loss from the business in 2004, which turned out to be a loss of $39,000. Now, another key thing is Mr. Brinkerhoff did not, in fact, get a salary during 2004 or 2005, as had been discussed in that earlier proposal. He did not, in fact, become an owner on January 1 of 2004. He became a 50% owner, and this is undisputed, on January 1st of 2005. Now, in this case, a key issue is Mr. Foote wants to cherry pick that reference to the 2003 receivables being maintained by him. That was in that earlier proposal. None of the other terms of that proposal, or some of the other terms of that proposal, were not ultimately followed by the parties. Now, what then happened, the business continued. Mr. Brinkerhoff, through another company that he owned, an employee leasing company called Rivas, infused quite a bit of capital, operating capital, into the business, which was ultimately then paid back by WET. A national competitor called Belfour, which we probably all heard of before, came into the picture in 2007 and bought all of WET's assets for the total price of $2,070,000, consisting of $1,070,000 down at that time, October 10th of 2007, followed by four $250,000 installments. Mr. Foote went to work for Belfour as part of the transition. WET continued on under a new name, D&B Complete, Inc., Darren and Bruce, D&B. And Mr. Brinkerhoff continued to receive the accounts receivable and pay the accounts payable on his own, on behalf of the company, reporting to Mr. Foote, who's of course with Belfour. Now, a disagreement arose because in February of 2009, if I recall correctly, Mr. Foote wrote Mr. Brinkerhoff an email and said he was still owed more money for the buy-in, and he was still owed the 2003 receivables. Now, the last reference in writing to the 2003 receivables was that January 1st, 2004 email, where it was part of several terms, many of which were never followed by the parties in their later course of conduct. Now, negotiations broke down, if you will, and suit followed, and Mr. Brinkerhoff came up on the losing end of the trial. The first issue I want to discuss is a rather technical and legal one, which is whether every claim in this case, except for the direct breach of contract action between Mr. Foote and Mr. Brinkerhoff, ought to have been brought as a derivative claim. And our position is, this is a situation where what admittedly might seem like sympathetic facts for Mr. Foote might make bad law for the state of Nevada. Rule 23.1 and the Schoen decision have made clear that there's a general rule to be applied. It can be applied in cases with 20 directors. It can be applied in cases as here with two directors. And it requires that when demand on the corporation under Rule 23.1 would be futile, as it admittedly would have been here, you've got two directors with equal power, one of whom is accused of wrongdoing, it would be futile to demand that he authorize the corporation to...
Wasn't the argument from the other side that there was an individual agreement between Mr. Foote and Mr. Brinkerhoff, so it's a personal claim as opposed to a corporate claim?
It is, and I agree with that to the extent of the breach of contract claim, because Mr. Foote is the one who gave the stock to Mr. Brinkerhoff, 50% on January 1 of 05. However, when we're talking about Mr. Brinkerhoff collecting accounts receivable after the sale to Belfour, and paying payables, allegedly making off with those receivables, distributing the initial payment from Belfour inequitably between the two shareholders, mismanaging a corporation, those are all damage to WET. And Mr. Foote, as a shareholder, he would ultimately stand to receive 50% of any money that went into WET and lose 50% in effect of any money that was misappropriated from WET.
Was this a Subchapter S corporation? Do you know? Did it come up? If it didn't, drop it. I'm just trying to think how you can do this distributions out of the corporation without them being dividends.
Those are the questions that kept me up last night, Your Honor. No, I don't know.
Can't okay, be. Then but I, let it go.
My understanding is it was basically a 50-50 distribution after Rivas was paid back and some other credit, not creditors, but accounts payable were paid.
Wasn't Rivas also owned by Mr. Brinkerhoff?
Rivas was owned by Mr. Brinkerhoff, yes. Yes. Now, the court may take up the District of Nevada, United States District Court for the District of Nevada, which in several opinions has predicted this court would adopt the closely held corporation exception, if you will. And I don't think that's necessary. I think when you have a case like this, with two directors, one of whom is interested, one of whom is the alleged wrongdoer, and demand is futile, you don't need to go through another special test and confuse this area of the law. You can just apply the simple demand futility test. Explain in the pleading why demand is futile, in basically as simple words as I just did. And then we can be consistent, we can have a simple bright line rule for litigators and litigants to follow, and it basically follows Schoen in Rule 23.1. And if you do adopt a close corporation test, I probably lose this argument, but I think you'd be unnecessarily confusing and complicating this area of the law. Now turning to, if I may, the statute of limitations. There was some key testimony in this case, and that is, it was admitted through Mr. Foote's deposition, which is a statement of a party opponent, was read into the record. I asked him whether the initial payment of $200,000 was due at least by the end of 2004, and he said, quote unquote, absolutely. I asked him whether the remaining installment payments of $40,000 were due on January 1 of 05, 06, 07, and 08, and he said, yes, they were.
And when was the lawsuit filed?
October 10th of 2011, exactly 4 years after the sale of the assets to Belfour. And the jury was instructed on the four-year statute of limitations for an oral contract. Another key fact, though, Your Honor, is that Mr. Foote testified, and it's the only evidence on this because Mr. Brinkerhoff testified he didn't recall this exchange, about a discussion at the Glendale office of Webb a few days or a week or so before the sale to Belfour. So a few days outside the four-year window within which to sue for breach of contract or the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. During that exchange, Mr. Foote claims he confronted Mr. Brinkerhoff, said, I'm owed X more dollars for the buy-in, I'm owed additional monies, and Mr. Brinkerhoff responded, I'm not going to pay any more money. I'll bankrupt the company first. Took issue with this. And Mr. Foote said this was very clear in his mind, and that it occurred before the sale. So more than 4 years after that statement, Mr. Foote decided to file suit. He's outside the four-year window. It is that simple. They tried to get around this by saying that, well, Mr. Foote also said he just was going to let this go until Mr. Brinkerhoff came into some money. Okay? That sort of forbearance, though, it might make sense to Mr. Foote because he doesn't want to rock the boat with his partner. He doesn't want to get in litigation for the partner with a going concern that they hope to sell one day. But be that as it may, he does have to fish or cut bait within 4 years of the accrual of his claim. He knew when these payments were overdue, and he knew they weren't paid. And he knew he wasn't going to get paid based on Mr. Brinkerhoff's statements more than 4 years before he sued. Now, the response has been, well, he did get more money, though. Mr. Brinkerhoff was not being candid during that discussion on Glendale because more money was given to Mr. Foote. That was simply 50% of the money that was left over from the Belfour initial payment and the subsequent installments from Belfour. Of course, he got 50%.
Well, it sounds like the statute of limitations here is kind of a mixed issue of fact and law, depending on how you interpret where these payments are applied to. Now, did the finder of fact make that determination regarding the statute of limitations, or was it a court determination?
It was instructed upon, although our proposed instruction about the accrual of installment payments was rejected by the court. But statute of limitations was instructed upon. It was just implicit in the verdict form. There was not a specific question. Was this within the statute?
So there's no special interrogatory or anything to address?
No, just the various claims.
Did you propose this, or your client proposed the special interrogatories to break this out?
It was such a request, I can't recall, but such a request was not rejected by the court, so that's not an issue here.
Okay.
The next issue, Your Honor, pertains to the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And the jury awarded $80,000 in connection with that claim. And indulge me. In the appendix at pages 842 to 843, there's a November 3rd, 2007 email and spreadsheet Mr. Brinkerhoff provided to Mr. Foote. Now, that's a couple of months after the sale to Belfour and the initial $1,070,000 payment. Mr. Brinkerhoff explained in that table where the money had gone. $129,000 to pay off some vehicle notes because Wett had kept the AP and AR. $65,000 to Mr. Foote's brother, Brian. For some reason or other. $276,000 in change to Mr. Foote, which he acknowledges he received. $200,000, $76,000 less, to Mr. Brinkerhoff, and some money for accounts payable. Okay? There was a $79,000 balance. Now, $79,000 in change. That is virtually identical to the $80,000 that was awarded. And based on the arguments of counsel, the evidence that's presented in the case, I think it is clear that that is what the jury was talking about here. They weren't asked to write out in parenthetical form what this represented, but given that this was breach of fiduciary duty, given that Mr. Brinkerhoff is charged with managing the monies from Belfour, distributing it, paying the bills and such, it's clear to this court and to me. The issue then becomes the fact that Mr. Brinkerhoff later emailed Mr. Foote and said, I've now received $250,000 of that initial payment. And Mr. Foote had received $276,000. Mr. Brinkerhoff also commented, I'm entitled to another $26,000 to bring the distributions even. So it was fully accounted for. Fully accounted for. I think there's a $3,000 difference. Nevertheless, the jury awarded breach of fiduciary duty damages for this. They misunderstood the evidence. It's not only a lack of substantial evidence that's clearly erroneous, it's contrary to the documentary evidence in the case. This is also indicated in the Nevada State Bank account statements and the general ledger, where this money went. It was just a mistake by the jury, quite candidly. And it's on a serious claim.
Did your client ask that the after the verdict came in, to the, had that matter resubmitted to the jury for clarification, or did the verdict just go forward at that
stage? The verdict just went forward. We didn't ask for clarification based on the verdict form that they given by the court. Now, lastly, as to conversion, I'm running a little short. This is an important one as well. It's a serious claim. Civil theft, basically. It was argued in closing argument that Mr. Brinkerhoff had sent an email after the sale to Belfour. He sent an email to Mr. Foote saying, we've got $700,000 in accounts receivable. About a third of that is uncollectible. And counsel then took that as, I think he said, the best evidence of what happened to those accounts receivable in the future. And he argued during closing argument, those accounts receivable, that yes, there was that 700,000 or odd number of accounts receivable. If a third was uncollectible, then the rest must have come in and half should have gone to Mr. Foote, but it didn't. So, ergo, Mr. Brinkerhoff must have taken it. As we've explained in the brief, and this isn't just based on the general ledger that Mr. Brinkerhoff maintained, this is based on the Nevada State Bank records. It's difficult to follow, but it's there. And the jury got lost on this. All of those accounts receivable and accounts payable, they wash out. That money did not, in fact, go missing. It was not, in fact, taken. It's just a mistake. And it should be corrected by this court with all due respect.
Counsel, there is there.
Thank you.
Allegations that the documents asked for those bank records were never provided. They did have a forensic accountant who came in, but were all of those documents actually provided, the bank records?
There were some bank records that were not ultimately able to be produced in discovery, not produced in discovery. However, the Nevada State Bank records, and that's the account through which the accounts receivable and accounts payable were handled after the sale to Belfour. There was another Zions Bank account for some operations in Utah. But that's the account that handled all the AR and the AP and everything we're talking about here with respect to the alleged $235,505 conversion claim. Those records were produced, were available, are in the record, and we've explained in the brief in detail how, I don't mean this pejoratively, we can follow the bouncing ball and see where the money went. And it was not converted. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Mark Ray, and I represent Darren Foote, the respondent. May it please the court and counsel. I want to make one point perfectly clear if I didn't make it clear in my brief. What you just heard and what is in the appellant's opening brief, Justices, is an argument about what the evidence showed, how the evidence should be interpreted, why the jury didn't understand the evidence. There was 160 exhibits. One of those exhibits was 2,500 pages long. We had a six-day jury trial. Judge Berry was presiding. Trust me when I tell you there was a lot of argument about what the evidence means, both in closing arguments and throughout the trial and testimony of witnesses. There was a complete disparity in this case between the truth as reported by Mr. Brinkerhoff and the truth as related by my client. And if you look, Justices, at their brief, you will find that fully 50%, this is a chart, a handwritten chart that I'm holding up here, fully 50% of the facts that are related to you as to what this case is about come directly from Mr. Brinkerhoff's testimony, a person whose, in my humble opinion, credibility was completely impeached during this trial on numerous points. And yet, we still have... Yes?
No, I'm sorry. Just another page for notes.
I never want to stop you from speaking. I'm very glad you're having this oral, this argument here because... without going through every single thing and repeating myself again, what you started off when there was a few words about the facts, I put that, a few words about the facts, there's more than a few words, the whole argument's about the facts. And we spent all that time with Judge Berry about the facts and with this jury.
Well, and could so you clarify, just to begin with, to analyze this particular case, why some of this should not be considered derivative?
Thank you. I think that none of the claims are derivative except for the possible exception of the $51,000 award for constructive fraud, which is the last award, $51,000 for constructive fraud. And here's how that happened. It's in our brief. About a month before trial, we found, in doing a spreadsheet internally at my office, that there was $102,000 that went into an offshore account of Mr. Brinkerhoff under the name of Rivas. This was in the Cayman Islands. We found that by doing a correlation between the two, the deposits going out to this account and deposits coming back. But we didn't have all the account records, as you pointed out. We didn't have all the records. We found this a month before trial because records were being collected. Despite the existence of forensic accountants, justices, we had no idea until a month before trial that this existed. When we went to trial, we brought this up. We presented this evidence, and we presented it in the form of saying, you know, this is a breach of fiduciary duty, or this is a conversion, or this is what constructive fraud. Any one of those things. The jury chose constructive fraud and awarded the $51,000. But every single other claim is absolutely an individual claim of my client, Mr. Foote. Every single one of them. The breach of contract claim is the money he's owed for his sale of stock. The breach of covenant of fair dealing money, the 200, forget the amount, that is for the 2003 receivables, which he's absolutely owed. He's owed those monies, not the company. The company can't sue for the 2003 receivables. The company has those 2003 receivables. How do you meet the argument that Mr. Brinkerhoff is making that the company has to sue for its own receivables that it already has? Mr. Foote sued because Mr. Brinkerhoff kept those receivables after the business closed. When Mr. Brinkerhoff was taking care of the closing down of this business, he kept the money. The same thing happened with the constructive fraud money. He kept the money that was in the account. The same thing happened with the conversion money, that is the conversion of, I'm missing my closing statement I made to the jury, but if you look at every claim that's in our brief, look at every claim. The monies that are owed are monies that are owed to Mr. Foote personally, not to Wett. Wett couldn't even bring these claims, with one exception. When Wett's money is taken offshore, $102,000, Wett can bring a claim for its money. I suspected that, and I filed a motion after trial, and I said to the judge, can we amend this complaint to add, as a party to this action, the company for the purpose of this $51,000 claim that we asked for half of it? And she said no because it's an individual claim. And she denied my motion to amend. This has happened after the trial. And yes, there's been some argument about whether you have to bring a derivative, whether all the requirements of NRCP 23.1 have to be complied with when you have a two-person partnership basically in the form of an LLC and one is suing the other. And as you know, Judge Reed said in Simon versus Mann more than 11 years ago that he doesn't think you do. And in Simon versus Mann, he made that finding. Now, counsel here is asking you not to go along with Simon versus Mann, but one thing that could happen if this case were to be published and have precedent, you could say whether or not in a case like this, these kinds of cases where there's two partners in this little tiny company and they're fighting over who's entitled to what, do you have to comply with every requirement of NRCP 23.1? Well, in Simon versus Mann by Judge Reed, which is mentioned in the briefing, he said a court in its discretion may treat an action raising derivative claims as a direct action, exempted from those restrictions and defenses applicable only to derivative actions, and order an individual recovery if it finds that to do so will not unfairly expose the corporation or the defendants to a multiplicity of actions, materially prejudice the interest of creditors of the corporation, or interfere with the fair distribution of the recovery among all interested persons. It's not the focus of my argument to say that this should be what was labeled an exception to the 23.1 requirements by Judge Reed should be necessarily adopted or not adopted. He said you would adopt it. I don't know if you would or not. But the only claim, the one and only claim that definitely I thought at the end of the trial could be a wet claim was this one. And do you know why it came up or how it came up? It came up at the very end of trial when Mr. Brinkerhoff filed a 17-page motion for under 50A for judgment as a matter of law, arguing that all the claims were derivative. We had been in litigation 3 years and 8 months, never once, not even in their trial brief filed before the trial started, had they ever said these were derivative claims, ever. Why did they say it then? I think it's because of this $51,000 claim that came up. And they're going, oh, that's derivative. What has that claim? Well, let's make the argument that all the claims are derivative. But
when was that argument made about all the claims were derivative? You said it wasn't made till later on?
Yeah.
When? I mean, was it
literally after the close of evidence,
So doesn't it have to be made at right at the beginning of the case under Rule 23?
My argument was, and this is one of the disputes in the argument. Yes, that standing under Rule 8C and 9A together, standing in capacity, and the cases that you've decided under that thing, I believe that it is an affirmative defense. It has to be raised.
This wasn't raised as an affirmative defense in the pleadings.
Or
that these claims are derivatives. Did Mr. Brinkhoff ever plead that?
He never pleaded it ever. Okay. Ever. And you have cases that I've cited to you.
Was his answer, did the court give him leave to amend his answer to assert those derivatives?
Yes, on March of 2014, 1 year approximately before the trial, he amended his answer and added 4 affirmative defenses. One of them was not objection to standing or objection that this was a 23.1 action. Never, ever raised until after all the evidence is over. Imagine going through a 6-day trial for a single guy like my client, Darren Foote, against Mr. Brinkhoff, putting all that work into a case, and then having the person at the end say, oh, well, you know, we don't have to raise standing that this is a derivative action. I say, yes, you do. Under Contrail, it says that they failed to plead the affirmative defense of lack of standing and capacity to sue. Both of those things, and I also raised it in the case of Shaw versus Stuxnet. I raised both those in my brief, Your Honors, and I respectfully believe that if you make us, as practitioners, go through this and someone doesn't have to raise that they think the claims are derivative until after the case is over and then you just start over again, that's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Okay. Can we get into the statute of limitations issue?
Sure.
I'm concerned about this money. It was due in 2003 or 2004,
okay.
And a suit's filed in 2011.
Sure.
Let us know about that.
Okay. So, Matt, the situation, the actual evidence, not Mr. Brinkhoff's version of it, but the actual evidence that the jury heard, the judge heard in denying the motion for judgment as a matter of law, is that in 2003, not Mr. Brinkhoff approached Mr. Foote, I mean, not Mr. Foote approached Brinkhoff, but Brinkhoff approached Foote in a successful business, and he wanted to be a 50% owner. The actual evidence is they made an agreement after some negotiations, which is evidence in emails, that there would be a $400,000 buy-in, okay? The $400,000 buy-in, how that would be paid became the issue. Not whether it was $400,000, but how to pay it. And how did they, it developed over time in 2003, that Mr. Brinkhoff started making payments towards this $400,000 at random amounts at random times. But basically $100,000 plus was paid. In 2004, they modified the agreement. As time went on, Mr. Brinkhoff was going, well, I'm not, you know, drawing a salary. By the way, he didn't draw a salary, justices. However, and this is never said by Mr. Brinkhoff, never admitted, he didn't draw a salary, but he took credit for the salary that was drawn by my client, Mr. Foote, from the company, and credited that against his buy-in for 2 years, okay, 2004, 2005. So he credits that, and we acknowledge that. In other words, there was an agreement for the buy-in, but it was modified. And the modifications included when the payments had to be made. By 2005, Mr. Brinkhoff was writing emails to my client saying, based on our agreement, this year you will receive $85,000 from receivables, $100,000 from unbilled 2003 work. This is Mr. Brinkhoff.
So your position is these payments were made so the statute hadn't started to run yet. There was no breach until later on. And did the jury make that determination on the statute of limitations?
Absolutely.
So it wasn't a court didn't decide that.
No, it was
submitted
to the jury. There were 3 instructions. They were told about the statute of limitations and how it accrues. In other words, literally, there was an accrual instruction. And so what he's doing, what's happening is, as Mr. Brinkhoff is now in this company and now he's exercising 50% of the rights starting in January 2005, he is the guy with control of the books and records and the money. He's opened up an offshore account in the Cayman Islands, and my client did not know our money was going offshore. He's doing all these things, okay? Now he comes to the court at the end of the trial and goes, well, my first payment was due $200,000 in 2003 or 2004, then $50,000 a year each time, so that was the agreement. He's ignoring everything that came after it, justices, everything that came after it for all those years. My client was taking out a mortgage on his house. Mr. Brinkhoff was supposedly was contributing money from Rivas, although it's a joke when he says that Rivas was infusing quite a bit of operating capital into this company. That wasn't the case at all. Rivas was taking money in the critical time periods when this company was desperate for cash. It was taking money offshore. That's the facts. So when we got to the trial, we got to this instruction about the accrual of the statute of limitations, the jury had to look at the evidence in total, including evidence, mind you, from Mr. Brinkerhoff himself, who testified that he did not have a finalized agreement for his buy-in until the closing of the sale to Belfour, October 7, 2007. Even though they now argue, oh, well, the money for my buy-in was due in 2004, 5, 6. In trial, Mr. Brinkerhoff said, I didn't even have an agreement for my buy-in until the money came in from Belfour. That's in my brief. And that's quoted to the record. This is an incredibly important point, because my client had been saying all along, until money became available to pay what he was owed for the 2000 receivables, to pay what he was owed, he was forbearing with the agreement of Mr. Brinkerhoff from requiring Mr. Brinkerhoff to make his payments. He forbore all those years waiting for money to come in that would be available to satisfy the claims owed to my client. That happened. The ship came in when Belfour sale happened, October 7, 2007. Now, the money was distributed after that. The payments came in after that. But my point is, at no time did Mr. Brinkerhoff have any basis for saying, oh, I owed you $50,000 on a payment in 2004. He got credits for those payments. He made some of those payments. There was a lot of things that happened. And now they're coming and arguing to you, well, the statute ran in 2004. No, it didn't. That's not the evidence in this case whatsoever. But it comes from the fact that more than half of the facts that you're being told today come from Mr. Brinkerhoff, whose testimony was discredited by this jury, rightfully so.
I want to go back to the $51,000. I'm looking at the verdict form on verdict form number 10. Gives the $51,000 for the constructive fraud.
Constructive fraud.
I wasn't sure if you were conceding that we should say that was a verdict.
You know,
how should we handle it?
Let's be honest. I mean, I thought, okay, if there's any validity to this, it's because of this $51,000. That's why it came up, because this came up a month before trial. So I'm not conceding it totally, but I am saying, yes, I thought at the time that I should file a motion for leave to amend to add the company as a party under Rule 15, because, you know, this $51,000 was really Wett's money. The whole $102,000 was Wett's money.
Mr. Ray, there's no cross appeal here, so you didn't appeal that denial of your motion, did you?
No. I mean, the judge said, no, it's not a derivative claim, and so my motion was denied. That's true. My motion was denied. But yes, I'm with you. I totally understand where you're coming from. Like, how can you stand there and talk about derivative if this isn't derivative? What is? And I'm saying, I agree with you. I mean, I filed the motion for leave to amend to add the company. And the judge said, no, it's really not. I can only say this. If you go with Judge Reed, or if you go with, you know, these other cases, is it? Oh,
well, finish your thought.
Okay. I mean, you have the power to say that there's an exception here and it could apply to this claim. But yes, frankly, you know, it was Wett's claim, and that's what I thought at the time. We argued it at the trial, and now we're arguing it in front of you. But aside from that, I make no concession with regard to that. I mean, it took $102,000 of our money, and we didn't know about it until a month before trial. What were we supposed to do, start over for that one claim? I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry. Thank you. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you to both attorneys for such challenging issues that you've raised before us. This case will stand submitted.